that should be your plan, is that you should be able to easily write a check for your full loan balance from your brokerage account in 20 or 25 years if you had to. And that just means that instead of saving whatever you're saving for your tax bomb, multiply it by two or three, and then you'd be able to cover the full loan balance right out of your brokerage account if you absolutely had to. Welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. This is Travis Hornsby, and today we are going to talk about PSLF forgiveness in general, like taxable forgiveness and income-based plans, and how risky it really is. And what's really fascinating to me is whenever I go over to like a Facebook group that's talking about student loans and I see some of the comments that people make, golly, people are terrified that the government and Congress is going to take something away. If you think about radio shows and different kind of personal finance experts out there, they really popularize the idea that Congress can't be trusted, the government can't be trusted, they're going to pull the rug out from under you, you're going to be totally screwed, and there's just absolutely nothing that you're going to be able to do that will allow you to rely on these forgiveness programs. And I actually think that that's really hurting people out there. It's really causing a lot of damage. Just today, I had a case where some person was paying an extra like $5,000 a year on loans that were set up to be forgiven. And golly, that just makes no sense. You're basically giving Uncle Sam free money if forgiveness can actually apply to you and the math supports it. And I'm going to prove it in this episode of our podcast today by going through a couple different talking points that'll hopefully convince you that people's fears about forgiveness and income-based plans are really anxieties that are not based on math, they're based on pure emotion. So we're going to talk about this issue in three different parts. We're going to first talk about PSLF, Public Service Loan Forgiveness. So if you're not interested in that or that doesn't apply to you, feel free to skip ahead. We're going to talk about loan forgiveness in general, the one that you do pay or repay or IBR and you have a tax bomb at the end of it. And then also we're going to talk about income-based plans and the risk that those face. So could IBR go away? Could repay go away? Could pay go away? These kind of questions. So first off, let's talk about public service loan forgiveness. This is a program that people always ask me, like, Travis, do you think that this is going to go away? What chance do you think this has of actually being a thing? And I like to compare PSLF to some other government programs that exist that people have also talked about repealing for some cases 10 years, in other cases 50 to 60 years, in other cases 70 to 80 years. So the first one that you'll be very familiar with is the ACA, the Obamacare plan, as it sometimes is called. That got passed about 10 years ago, give or take, right? That program got passed, and the political discussion has been about nothing but repealing or replacing that, you know, with the Republicans. Democrats in some cases would like to go further than that. But this is a program that everybody feels like, oh, it's not safe. Even my in-laws that could potentially benefit from some ACA subsidies, they've been like, oh, we can't use that. It's going to go away. But guess what? It hasn't gone away. And one of my friends actually works for one of these big insurance companies that does ACA and Medicaid plans, and their stock is absolutely booming under a Republican administration. Why is that? Because Wall Street is basically saying that that program is going absolutely nowhere. And so what's interesting about that is if you think about the ACA, that's something that, yeah, it could go away, right? It could also get more beneficial in terms of the people who benefit from it. It could get more generous if you had, you know, an all Democrat controlled House, Senate, and White House. And it's unlikely to completely go away. Even the Republicans have proposed to keep the pre-existing condition protection, right? So that's a 10-year-old program that has shown really no signs of going away, even though that's a very, very hot button issue and something that costs probably in the trillions of dollars long term. And that's something that they have not been able to successfully replace or repeal. Medicare is a program that got started in the 60s, and Medicare had tons of opposition when it came about. This is a program that also has gotten steadily more generous over time. The taxes to fund Medicare are a percentage withdrawal from your pay stubs, basically, from your paycheck. And the Medicare tax has gone steadily up, and the payouts to doctors and the stuff that it covers has also expanded over time. Even so, the Medicare program is massively underfunded. We have to make tons of changes to this program to be able to keep it, regardless of what kind of side of the aisle you're on. Now, there's different ways to do that, And you could either have higher taxes, you could put them on everybody or the wealthy, or alternatively, you could lower payments to providers like doctors and physicians and other people that take Medicare and maybe have fewer people accept Medicare. It would be more difficult to get access to care, or you could do some combination of that. But Medicare has been around for 50, 60 something years, and it has shown no potential to go away because we as Americans, when we pass a program, once it gets sort of to the point of critical mass where you have enough people benefiting from it, it's too politically popular to kill it. That's just reality. Social Security has been around since the 30s, I think, and that is a program that is even older than Medicare and probably even more popular, I would have to guess. And that is something that everybody always scaremongers people into saying that, you know, Social Security is not going to be around for future generations. And that's just patently false. The reason is because we had tons of seniors in poverty before Social Security, and AARP exists, and it is a massive lobby for Social Security, and Social Security is absolutely going nowhere. In fact, what will probably happen is you'll have some sort of benefit cuts or tax increases, but probably both, and it's going to stay around and not go away. One thing that is that all three of those programs, ACA, Social Security, and Medicare, have in common is that they will cost trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars to cover, and it is the vast majority of where our basically our budget deficit and our spending goes. It's really kind of funny to me when people don't know like the budget. It's really fascinating if you look at things like discretionary spending and pork barrel projects and all those other things, interest on debt. It's actually a minority of the budget. The majority of the budget goes to, you know, social programs like the three that I mentioned. That's pretty interesting. So in other words, student loans, even though it is very, very expensive in the grand scheme of things, the forgiveness that the government has promised, and even the projected forgiveness that I think that the government has promised under PSLF is in the hundreds of billions right now, which sounds like a lot, but that's over a long period of time. And if you compare that to an underfunded liability on some of these other programs in the tens of trillions, it's really kind of small potatoes. So, you know, you probably have bigger priorities if you're Congress than eliminating this one program. But let's talk about it anyway. Let's talk about the history of PSLF repeals. So in 2015, approximately, President Obama submitted a budget, I believe, that had PSLF being capped for the first time at about $57,500. That is an important number because that's approximately what the undergraduate borrowing limit is for Stafford loans. In other words, President Obama was effectively saying, or at least his staff was effectively saying, you know, we don't think that it is wise to give out PSLF forgiveness to graduate degree holders. And that's why we want to try to limit it to people who basically come out of undergrad and do a public service job and they can get their debt forgiven. And people lost their minds, especially higher debt borrowers, and they called their congresspeople, their senators, all the borrower advocates that exist in Washington, D.C. did the same, and the president dropped that proposal, and it did not make it into any kind of bill. And Senator Mitch McConnell, who, you know, is running the Senate, has been running the Senate for several years now, basically tried to repeal PSLF around that same time, except his proposal would basically just apply for new borrowers only. It wouldn't be capped. It would just be gone. And that went absolutely nowhere, even though the proposal was only to repeal it for future borrowers instead of existing borrowers. Even the cap on forgiveness, it was very unclear because it wasn't well fleshed out, but that probably would have only applied to future borrowers. The PROSPER Act in 2017, approximately, the House Republicans tried to put out a proposal for their own version of, you know, what they wanted to do for student loans. The House is always more conservative generally than the Senate. And when Republicans control the House, their proposals for student loans tend to be more conservative than the Senate would want to pass. So the PROSPER Act was very, very conservative. It put a hard cap on borrowing for degree programs, and it made it a lot less generous to pay student loans under income-based plans. Yet that plan went nowhere because it didn't have enough support in the Senate. And it did not pass. Yet that super conservative bill would have grandfathered in people that are going for PSLF currently. Now, from the other side of the aisle, the AIM Higher Act was a Democratic proposal around the same time that there was the House Democrats' version of student loan reform, and it would drastically expand a PSLF, which makes sense because if you think about the big debates in Washington right now, it's over how much of different goods should society pay for, like education, healthcare, you know, should there be a jobs guarantee? infrastructure, all these things, like how much of our lives should government cover and how much of it should we cover as private citizens, right? And so what's going on with that debate is if you look at the Democrats' proposal with the AIM Hire Act, it would include places like Kaiser Permanente. That's a hospital system in California and other places that cannot employ physicians directly. They have to employ them through a for-profit group. So those physicians normally would be PSLF eligible because of this weird California strange rule about employing physicians not directly. Kaiser Permanente hospitals are not PSLF eligible. This bill would have focused on trying to fix that and also broaden the definition, make it a lot easier to get PSLF if you made mistakes in the past by putting more money into the temporary PSLF fund. So that bill was a very generous pro-PSLF bill that made no mention of caps on borrowing. So we've really had zero mention of any caps on PSLF since President Obama put it in the budget in 2015, which is really interesting. And that's been the case for either party. Neither party has wanted to cap borrowing forgiveness for PSLF since 2015 at all. Just the proposals from Republicans have been to repeal it and Democrats have been to expand it. And it's really been that simple since then. In 2019, you've had different proposals come out from Senators Gillibrand and Tim Kaine, and then also Elizabeth Warren. There was this What Can You Do for Your Country Act. This was a bill that would also expand PSLF. It would count prior payments made on loans before consolidations. It would have helped with people that had FFEL loans from before 2010 to make those loans eligible for forgiveness. And you also would have been able to get PSLF 50% after 5 years. In other words, you could work for 5 years in a not-for-profit and have half your loans forgiven with their bill. So in other words, Democrats have kind of changed their position of being reserved about PSLF to basically unqualified being for it in a big way. So, you know, you could debate why this is. One reason might be Democrats are trying to get incremental progress to get to the point where college is free and covered by the government. Republicans are kind of just very opposed to the idea of doing it at this point, except we're starting to see some cracks in that, especially in the more moderate Senate. So we'll talk about that in a second. That's what's so fascinating to me is some of the proposals right now in the Senate, specifically with Senator Alexander, who controls the Higher Education Committee in the Senate. He has basically proposed to, he hasn't really even mentioned PSLF really all that much. I mean, I'm presuming that they would want to repeal it, but I think his proposal is just mainly focused on getting something passed where he can have an impact on student loan policy for the next 10 to 15 years. And it seems like the Senate Republicans have really kind of lost some interest in trying to defeat PSLF after trying to do it so many times. I think that if they had control over everything, they would still try to do it. But it would, again, only be for future borrowers. But it's interesting to me that the median position in Washington has become more and more pro-PSLF over time as more people qualify for it. Right now, there's over a million people qualifying for PSLF with over $100 billion on track to be forgiven. That's the current setup. And there's all kinds of problems with the way the process is being managed right now that won't affect those people long term. It's just, it's very complicated. If you want to go back and listen to it, I would go back and listen to, like, I think episode 2 of our podcast, where we talk a little bit about PSLF and what the reasons are for the high rejection rate and why that's not a big deal compared to what people think. The next thing I want to mention too is PSLF borrowers are a huge interest group. This is a lot of people with a lot of education that are very, very good at knowing where to contact their senators and congresspeople. I get emails from readers sometimes and listeners that are saying stuff like, you know, they contacted all of their different representatives, constituent services offices, and they got some deals set up with them so that they could expedite the process of qualifying, and they tell them how important it is. And, you know, that makes a lot of sense. A lot of these folks with PSLF are got mid five figure to high six figure balances. And you better believe that these people are going to be very dialed in to this particular issue. And if you have a system or a thing like PSLF that doesn't cost a lot compared to big, big expensive programs like Medicare, Social Security, you know, if it doesn't cost a whole lot to make a lot of super highly engaged constituents happy as a politician, that's like a rational decision to not mess with that. Let me give you an example to prove, though, even though PSLF is not very risky for it going away, let me show you why it doesn't really matter that much if it did. And some of you probably listening are like, wow, you're a terrible person, Travis. I hate you. That is something I don't even want to consider. And let me explain why you shouldn't be so worried about it. Let's take a family medicine physician, so somebody that's making, you know, $200,000 a year, and we'll say she's got $300,000 in loans, and she could go for PSLF or not PSLF, right? And she's got a three-year residency, which means she's making $60,000 a year for 3 years, and then after that, she's making $200,000. And we'll assume that she could live on $10,000 per month really well with a comfortable living standard, or that's about $120,000 a year. Okay, so we've got a doctor. Maybe we can say, you know, Dr. Christine or something like that. And she's got 120,000 is her financial independence number that she's trying to hit. And she's got a $60,000 per year residency and a $200,000 a year income when she finishes training with a 300K in debt, right? Just to review those stats. So at 15% of her income going to loans and investing, when could she have work be optional? If you do pay as you earn, in this case, with public service loan forgiveness, she would hit a level where she could spend $120,000 per year after 35 years. So that's a pretty long time, right? And that's a 15% savings rate. So about, you know, 10% going to loans, 5% going to retirement approximately is a 15% level going to loans and investing. If you say that she works in the private sector, pay as you earn would actually still be the cheapest plan. You would just do it in the 20-year version with a tax bomb instead of the 10-year version with PSLF. So in that scenario, how many more years would she have to work until she would be able to retire? The answer is 40. So 35 with pay-as-you-earn and PSLF, or 40 years until financial independence with pay-as-you-earn without PSLF. So that's 5 additional years that she would have to work because of not getting the PSLF program. What if she saved more money? If this doctor saved 30% going to loans and investing, then she would have 26 years until financial independence or being able to retire with pay and PSLF, or 29 years without. So 15% savings rate, 5 years cost if PSLF goes away of working. 30% savings rate, 3 years cost of PSLF going away. At a 50% savings rate, she would be able to retire in 20 years with PSLF or 21 years without PSLF. And just in case you're curious, refinancing would cause her to work 22 years. So pay as you earn with PSLF, basically the PSLF program in this case is worth about 1 year at a high savings rate and a 5 years with a bad savings rate or a low savings rate. That's really fascinating because that kind of illustrates a little bit of what I want to show you with this podcast today. With people with a low savings rate, which there's a lot of folks out there with low savings rates. Most people have low savings rates. Low savings rates to me is if you're putting less than 5% of your income into investments in retirement, right? Because your loans, you can't really eat your loans in retirement, right? The money you're going on your loans, you know, really doesn't really count that much towards what you're putting into investments. So, you know, if you think about like the typical American's probably saving about 5%. Going to retirement and investing. Given that you have the loans though, that's why I use that 15% number, because that's what's being eaten up by loans, investing, and retirement if you're doing a 15% savings rate. So anyhow, let's pretend a different scenario, because you're probably listening. Some of you out there are listening, and those of you that do send me email, podcast@studentloanplanner.com, you might send something like, yeah, great example, Travis, but that's a freaking $200,000 a year person. That's not a $60,000 a year person that's got $300,000 in debt that would be totally destroyed without PSLF. So I don't believe you. PSLF is my everything. And in that scenario, let's run some more numbers, right? So we'll pretend we've got a $60,000 per year psychologist or something like that working in a, you know, not-for-profit setting, and she's just convinced that PSLF going away would be the end. And if you look at that 50% savings rate, then if you have PSLF, this psychologist with the low income with $300,000 of debt, so in other words, a 5-to-1 debt to income ratio, holy cow, that's really high, right? 20 years until she could retire with PSLF and 23 years without. So that would be an additional 3 years of working if PSLF went away. Now, 1 to 5 years of driving into the office every day because PSLF went away, that's pretty intense. I'll grant that. Right? But the difference between a 15% savings rate and a 30% savings rate is 10 fewer years of you driving into the office. And the difference between a 15% savings rate and a 50% savings rate is about 20 years of you driving into the office. So we'll come back to that. But clearly, PSLF is not nearly as important as something you can control, which is your savings rate. So people that are really worried about PSLF going away, here is my theory. There's two kind of people that get super anxious about PSLF. One is somebody who is an incredible saver, who's got $500,000 of assets, you know, knows everything about backdoor Roth IRAs, would never hire a financial advisor because they probably know more than them, and somebody who is just super type A about their finances. And they're worried that it's going to go away because anything that reduces the amount of net worth that they have is terrifying because they're super OCD about their finances. And there's a lot of folks out there. I probably am one of these kind of people. And you just kind of get anxious about something that if you really think about it, you're saving so much money, you don't really have to worry about it that much because it's going to be a minor portion of your net worth one day. So that's one group of people that get super anxious about PSLF going away. The other group of people, and I see this a lot on Facebook groups from my guesses, is, you know, it's people who save very little. Folks that have the 3 to 3.5 times their income house that they talk themselves into a house being an investment when that's a joke that it's an investment in some really high cost parts of the country. It's a lifestyle decision, right? So if you spend a lot of money on housing and cars and you don't save very much and you don't track what you spend, then you've got a really low savings rate, then yeah, you know, I just told you earlier that a low savings rate means that PSLF has a bigger impact. So if you're really worried about PSLF, the natural thing that you need to do is save more money. Okay, so I'm done ranting about PSLF. Let's talk about taxable loan forgiveness because that's applying to a lot of people out there, probably even more people that PSLF applies to. So let's talk real quickly about the history of people doing, you know, income-driven programs that are not going to get their loans forgiven tax-free, and they're going to do it over 20 or 25 years instead of 10 years like those lucky PSLF rascals out there. You know, it's a podcast, right? You got to entertain yourself. So sorry if I called you a rascal. So ICR is a program that was around prior to 2007. It's been around actually, I think, since the 90s, income contingent repayment. The problem is you had to have a PhD in Department of Education and bureaucracy to figure out how to sign up for it. And even if you did sign up for it, it was such a high percentage of your income that very, very few people ever ended up benefiting from it. And also prior to 2007, you had all these folks that were benefiting from like 2% interest rates, right? That people have just decided to keep their loans around for much, much longer. And that is not a reason why you would want to pay a high percentage of your income on a loan that's like a 2% interest rate, right? And that's like the interest rates of the mid-2000s were in the 2% range. In 2007, they passed IBR for the first time, which in other words, they made it easy to sign up for an income-based plan when it was extremely complicated before. And then in 2009, they didn't really make IBR available until 2009. And then in 2013, approximately, pay-as-you-earn, which is a 20-year plan, became available. So if I'm doing my math right off the top of my head, income-based repayment with no PSLF, you're going to start seeing people get their loans forgiven on that in 2034. With pay-as-you-earn, you're going to see people getting their loans forgiven as early as 2033 if you're not going to go for PSLF. So what's interesting is basically the 2020s and the very early 2030s, you're going to see nothing but a whole bunch of hullabaloo about PSLF, and you're not going to see any tax bombs. So do not expect any big stories about that happening over, like, especially the early 2020s, because all the focus is going to be on this massive amount of money that the government is forgiving for 25% of the American workforce that works in a not-for-profit or government employer full-time. Congress has proposed bills to get rid of this tax bomb. All the time, a congressperson is presenting some sort of bill that would eliminate the tax bomb and make the loan programs in the private sector or working part-time or not at all even make that tax bomb go away. That's a very popular thing to propose. It just generally never goes anywhere. And the reason for that is I think Congress is, one, not really focused on it, doesn't really care that much about it compared to other things that are higher on their priority list. Two, I think Congress does not want to encourage people to take tons of debt knowing that there will be absolutely no consequences for it whatsoever, because that would spiral the debt size even more than it already is. So they can't acknowledge that that's what they're basically doing, is creating a tax bill that's too large to be paid, because then the Government Accountability Office and the CBO and all these like watchdog groups would have to actually account for the true cost of these loan programs in reality, and they would give the public a number that would be really embarrassing. So I think that there's some reasons that they do not want to expose what the true cost of forgiveness is going to be. And if you want to look up some really fun loan trivia, then you can check out this Minnesota State Representative Greg David's bill. It's HF882, if you want to Google it. And this is a bill that decided that basically killed the tax bomb at the state level for Minnesota tax filers. So for people who are having their loans forgiven in the state of Minnesota, Minnesota will not be collecting income taxes on that forgiven balance. And I would expect that you would have a lot more bills like that passed nationwide for state income taxes. Michigan passed the bill to eliminate taxation on, you know, forgiven student loan debt from disability and death, because of a really embarrassing case of them trying to collect on income taxes on a veteran who had a traumatic brain injury, and they were not able to collect the tax bill, for one, because he had a traumatic brain injury, duh. And also, it was really embarrassing that the state officials were trying to do this when, wow, is that just super incompetent in terms of the way that looks, right? That somebody's trying to collect an income tax bill from a veteran who's got a serious wound from serving your country in Iraq or Afghanistan, right? So I would expect more and more bills passed that would eliminate the tax bomb at the state level. At the federal level, I do not think that politicians will eventually collect it. I'm scared to tell you that, because, you know, I'm really afraid that there's at least one listener, hopefully it's not you, that is thinking, all right, let's spend some money, because I'm not going to have to pay my tax bomb at all. And that would be really bad if that happens, because there's a long, long history of politicians trying to eliminate the tax bomb, but it is not so much that I'm prepared to say you shouldn't plan for it, because there's been different plans, right? So President Trump has toyed around with the idea of doing a 30-year plan, which is worse than what currently exists, but he would have no tax bomb. So that's one kind of approach. Democrats have talked about doing pay as you earn for everybody, which is a 20-year plan, but also eliminating the tax bomb as well. So the reality might be somewhere in between those two options. Or the IRS will just apply the insolvency rule and tax the people that have the money, and the people who don't have the money, where your assets are less than your liabilities. There's this insolvency rule that's primarily applied in the case of, you know, weird forgiven debts like credit card or business debt or something like that. And basically, if you owe more in liabilities than you have in assets, they just don't even tax the debt, because they just figure there's no point in kicking somebody when they're down. So the really probably the worst case scenario in terms of what will happen at the end of the 20 or 25 years or even 30 years is you will pay income taxes in the forgiven balance. I cannot imagine any scenario whatsoever where they will just tell you, well, yeah, you have $500,000 and we're just going to tell you you owe the whole thing. I mean, golly, there is just no scenario where that's even possible, I think. If they did that, then in reality, every system that's ever been proposed has allowed you to consolidate into whatever the new loan program is every 10 years or so. So you could just consolidate it into the new program and just keep rolling the debt and not even worrying about making that balloon payment. So I think that people who are worried about themselves owing that big forgiven balance all at once, instead of just paying a tax bomb on it, are being very irrational, for one. And two, again, I showed you earlier how important savings rate is. The same numbers apply for people considering refinancing versus forgiveness with that 20 or 25 year tax bomb option. So refinancing versus going for the tax bomb, you know, at a low savings rate, it's probably worth about 5 years. At a high savings rate, it's worth 3 years. A super high savings rate, it's worth 1 year on average. So that means that if you did have to pay that full balance all at once because of some just crazy, crazy thing, then if you have a high savings rate, you'll be able to write the check, and you know, you won't have any excuses because you will have had a high savings rate and you'll have a lot of assets. So if you're worried about that, generally I get those kind of questions from folks that haven't realized how important savings rates really are. So that should be your plan, is that you should be able to easily write a check for your full loan balance from your brokerage account in 20 or 25 years if you had to. And that just means that instead of saving whatever you're saving for your tax bomb, multiply it by like two or three, and then you'd be able to cover the full loan balance right out of your brokerage account if you absolutely had to. you know, if you think about taxable loan forgiveness, Congress just has so many more things that are more pressing right now. Everything from questions around the Trump administration to different national security concerns, trade, immigration, the 2020 election. There's just a lot of other things that people care about more. And whenever people do talk about loan forgiveness, they tend to just talk about some, you know, on the Democratic side, some sort of, you know, very aspirational proposal that would never pass, you know, a Republican Senate in 100 years. Or they'll talk about some sort of kind of vague proposal, how they're going to help with the debt problems or something, right? Like, you don't really see a lot of fleshed out proposals. If you did have a Democratic sweep at some point, I would expect things to get a lot more generous when it comes to taxable loan forgiveness. If you had a Republican sweep, then I just think that they would clamp down on those programs to try to limit it for the future, because they're not interested in screwing over their constituents, because a lot of high income people vote. And the ones that have higher incomes, in some cases, are Republican voters, if you think about it, right? So you really wouldn't want to mess with the constituents that are your highest likelihood voters. In terms of income-driven plans, this is the part three. This is the last part of the podcast talking about this one. So income-driven plans have only gotten more and more generous over time, with basically one exception. You've had ICRs, 20% of your income, with a deduction that's 100% of the federal poverty line. Income-based repayment is 15% of your income with a deduction of 150% of the poverty line. So IBR increased the deduction that you don't have to pay loans on, or you don't have to pay payments on your income. It also reduced the percentage that they multiply to calculate what your payment is. So that was more generous. Pay as you earn kept that 150% poverty line deduction, but went down from 15 to 10% of your income. And you could file taxes separately, exclude your spouse's income, that kind of thing, just like IBR. Then revised pay as you earn, you could argue, got a little less generous, but it gave you a new option, because revised pay as you earn gives interest subsidies if your income is low relative to your debt. And low meaning anything with a debt to income ratio over 1.5 to 1 in general, or 2 to 1, approximately around that level. So maybe you could say, with the exception of repay, these programs have gotten more and more generous. Repay became a 25-year plan instead of a 20-year plan, so a little bit less generous, and it forces you to include your spouse in the repayment calculation. But repay also gave interest subsidies, where pay as you earn did not give interest subsidies. So if they were going to make these loan forgiveness programs less generous, they would have not done an interest subsidy, but they did. So all they did was create yet another option that people could utilize to cut the cost of their student loans. If you kind of think about it, that makes sense a little bit, because the IBR was a bipartisan idea. That's basically income share agreements. Like, think about like Mitch Daniels at Purdue wanting to give the option to private investors to be able to offer programs where you could pay based on a percentage of your income instead of some sort of debt-based lending program. And you see this with some like coding bootcamp schools, where they'll take a percentage of your earnings instead of actually charge you a bill, right? So IBR, bipartisan idea, President Bush, Democratic Congress. And then President Obama had that very Democratic Congress in 2010, 2009 kind of era during the financial crisis. And that Congress passed a more generous version of IBR, and it was not ready to be implemented quite yet by the 2012 election. So how did pay-as-you-earn come about? President Obama was obviously looking for political advantages to win the election, like any politician would, and found this loophole with pay-as-you-earn, where they could speed up this implementation of this cheaper loan repayment program, but they couldn't have it apply to everybody because the congressional action would take more time to develop. So that's why they passed pay-as-you-earn, and President Obama gave that speech in front of, I think it was the University of Iowa graduating class of 2012, during a campaign event in Iowa. And they structured it so that the pay-as-you-earn program would, the first group of people that could use it would be people that started school and didn't take out any loans prior to like 2007. So that basically would be the class of 2012, right? So, you know, if you think about it, it makes sense. Like, you know, a president giving a speech wants to make a more generous repayment program that's on its way already, but they want to speed it up so they can have it get started before the 2012 election. And that graduating class needs to all qualify, so they'll clap. You know, I kind of view politics as just very pragmatic in terms of the way I look at it, right? So that's why pay-as-you-earn happened. And then repay, which is kind of what Congress intended to eventually happen, where it would apply to a lot more people, that got pushed through eventually over the more conservative Congress that took over after that first, very progressive Congress that was around. So President Obama passed that, I believe, with an executive order, and that applied to more people. And they had a few tweaks around the edges, probably to, I don't know exactly why. I probably shouldn't speculate on that regard, but maybe it was just to avoid, Republicans trying to oppose what President Obama did more aggressively with passing repay. So anyhow, you had ICR, super not easy to use, not very generous at all. IBR, bipartisan, more generous, a lot easier to access, and then more of a Democratic push to have even cheaper repayment programs that were more generous. But then that dialed back a little bit with repay, because I think that there were some concerns that high-income earners were excluding, some spousal income from the payment. And in general, you see tax penalties for all high-income earners that are married to one another. If you want to avoid paying too much in taxes, don't get married if you both make over $200,000. Congress doesn't want you to be married. If you look at the tax rates for, a couple making over $200,000 each, the tax rates in general cause you to pay more taxes than if you were single. So kind of in line with that sort of viewpoint, that's, I think, why repay prevented people from excluding their spouse's income. So I think that was just trying to bring the repay program more in line with what the tax code does. So there's a new option that they're trying to pass. It's the, I would call it kind of like the new pay-as-you-earn. This is sort of a Republican idea, for the most part, that they would withdraw it from pay stubs and it would be a 20-year program and the loans would be forgiven. Probably you could toss old loans into this. This is not a thing right now. You don't have to worry about this for now. But if it did become a thing, imagine a scenario where a dentist becomes a practice owner and can pay 10% of their income withdrawn from their pay stub. But most dentists and dental specialists set a pay stub to whatever they want it to be based on their taxes, right? So their CPA will say, we'll just set it at $100,000 so we pay a lot less in Social Security and Medicare taxes, and then we can do profit distributions on Schedule Ks that are actually not subject to payroll taxes. So you're able to get around a lot of those hefty 15%, 3% FICA taxes. I mean, 12% I think Social Security and 3% for Medicare approximately, I think is the approximate numbers. So if you put more of your income in profit distributions, then that will give you, more access to not having to pay as much in taxes. And so if you were able to do a pay as you earn, but directly from your pay stubs, golly, that would be a bonanza for people avoiding, payments on their student loans. That could happen. And it would also exclude spousal income as well. So that would be a program that's proposed by Republicans, and it's even more generous than repay or pay. And I don't know if that'll pass. Maybe some of the more conservative Republicans would realize that would be a bonanza and they'll resist that, but it could happen. So, if you think about it, that would eliminate the tax penalties for married filing separately, where that wouldn't even be a thing anymore. So what could happen to you if you have loan forgiveness, PSLF, or income-based repayment eliminated? If you are a bad saver, a whole lot of bad things could happen to you. You could drive into work for a whole 5 extra years for no freaking reason, other than you borrowed a lot of money and you don't have a great plan for paying it back, right? Or you lose access to the plan that you did have for paying it back. So what if you save 15% versus 30% savings rates? Going from 15% to 30% savings rates can take off 10 years off of your working career. Guess how many people, so 30% savings rate, by the way, is like 10% going to loans and 20% going to investing. So we did a survey and we asked our readers and listeners for the student loan planner community, how many of you save more than 20% going to like savings and investments? Fewer than 10% of people said that they did that. So fewer than 1 in 10 people have more than 20% going to investments. So you got 90% of our community, which is really smart, really engaged, really focused on their finances, right? Fewer than 1 in 10 people have this high savings rate, which is going to save them, and I would say medium high savings rate, like 30% is definitely something that you can hit. Fewer than 10%, fewer than 1 in 10 people are hitting that. And what's fascinating to me is you see so many people on social media that are so apoplectic about the idea of loan forgiveness going away, especially in places like, there's like PSLF Facebook groups and different places like that that I read and have great information, but people are just so terrified about these loan forgiveness programs going away. And at that low savings rate, yeah, they maybe have a point. But at a high savings rate, why would you get worried about something that at most would cost you 6 months to a year longer in your working career? right? You only would know that if you understood how the math worked. But what's interesting to me is so many people are worried about something they cannot control, that if they have a high savings rate, has a very modest impact, versus being worried about something that you absolutely can control, like savings rate, that you can figure out yourself just by focusing on tracking your spending, making sure money is going into brokerage accounts or retirement accounts, and getting a handle on your student loan debt. So fix your mindset where your focus is on what you can control, and then you really won't have to worry that much about whether or not PSLF or loan forgiveness or income-based repayment is here or if it goes away. So that would be my recommendation this week, is to focus on what you can control, focus on your savings rate, and stop worrying about the risk of forgiveness and PSLF and income-based repayment going away, because that risk is vastly overestimated. Thanks for listening to today's show. If you're ready to schedule your custom student loan plan, visit studentloanplanner.com/book and pick a time that works for you. The show notes are available at studentloanplanner.com/the number of today's episode. Finally, if you love your Student Loan Planner podcast, help us out and leave us a review or share it with someone who owes more than you.